Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, listeners. So happy you're with us.
And on the political right, John Dougal.
Great to be back.
Yeah, great to be with you, too. Listen, I want to go through a little bit of a lightning round here.
Okay.
You with me?
Yep.
We're going to do the Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who's...
I'm sorry, your time's up.
He started this Operation Southern Spear targeting narco-terrorists. They keep blowing up these boats in the Caribbean, John, and it's throwing me off because I think of our country.
Not just the Caribbean, but that's where most of them are.
Okay.
Some in the Pacific.
I think of our country as this moral leadership and rule of law and, you know, right to a fair trial kinds of things, and we keep taking people out.
Yeah. They're being accused of terrorists. I don't think this quite hits what we think of terrorists when we think of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. I don't think they quite pose the same risk to national security. But clearly, the president's getting kudos for, you know, quote unquote,
being
his
tough.
Being tough.
But
my fear is we're going to get dragged into a war.
Yeah, that sounds. There's a little bit of that. They use this term, Shireen, unlawful extrajudicial killings.
Yeah. Okay. So unlawful, I think, is a critical part of this. This administration is clearly willing to break or bend or disregard really laws of international engagement. And I do think you're exactly right. The risk here is multi-layered. You're talking about our moral standing in the world. I think that's critically important. Mm-hmm. I also think that this is leading to a more chaotic and more risky scenario in terms of further engagement in wars that Americans do not want to be in.
Well, some of our partners have said they're going to stop sharing intelligence with us as a result of this action.
Interesting. Shireen, 900,000 Palestinians, they're facing a flood risk, heavy rains, they're displaced. You can't. I mean, this stuff's so hard.
It's so hard.
They can't win.
Right.
When Mother Nature turns against you as well.
Completely. And frankly, we haven't returned to this subject in a while, but the ceasefire was short-lived. It's had some back and forths. I think there is some general progress here, but not nearly enough to address the kind of suffering that we're talking about and the amount of people that are going to continue to lose their lives as, again, I think our moral leadership is a total vacuum.
Interesting. John, you're welcome to comment on that, or I'm also wanting to go to the...
It's just tragic.
Yeah, tragic. Shut down. 43 days. It's done. The president
Set
has
a record,
signed it.
Yes. Thank you, Democrats.
People are getting their back pay and the SNAP food stamp monies are going out. But the thing that troubles me is the bill is only through the end of January. What were they thinking?
Well, part of it. Is
tell the listeners
more. The continuing resolutions through the end of January. Some of the food stamp payment stuff is, I think, through the end of the fiscal year. So that's, I think, into September, end of September, but maybe it's longer than that. But yeah, this is the classic thing for Congress. They kick the can a few months here, a few months there, as if magically that's going to solve all the problems after we've seen, what is it, in 50 years, they've properly followed the budgetary procedure four times or something? I mean,
I would have at least kicked it to like March.
Yeah.
Just because we'll find ourselves in a similar situation.
Well, they kicked it to, you know, basically the end of this week, and the shutdown ran so long that they basically ran out of time.
Yeah. Shireen, what do you reflect on this? Do you think the Democrats, did anybody win here or did both sides lose?
I think about the Utahns who went hungry. I think about the uncertainty that folks had across this entire state and certainly federal workers across this entire nation. I think about the amount of people that we are probably losing that are highly skilled and highly qualified to be in government jobs who are just saying, I've had enough of this, of the uncertainty and the risk associated with serving in these roles. So I think there's a lot of damage being done. But really, you know, for me, I think the issue that really sort of sticks in my the bee in my bonnet is that we did not get progress on healthcare. And I'm really curious to see, I guess the agreement is there will be one vote on healthcare. People across the state are receiving information right now. We have a high number of folks on the marketplace, on the ACA. Their healthcare in costs are going up.
Yeah.
This state's not doing anything. The federal government didn't do anything.
Yeah. John, what I would love to see as this goes down is I want them to be accurate in the way they characterize things. If they're going to use fraud, waste, and abuse, I want to make sure it's fraud, waste, and abuse, you know, and that's what I'm watching for in that discussion, because it's real easy to say, get rid of fraud. Everybody's for that.
And waste and abuse. They're all for that.
Yeah. But
it doesn't rack up to be enough money to cover the whole deficit.
Is it waste and abuse to help someone with health insurance that's 200% of poverty? you know, 300% of the federal poverty level? Yeah. You know, those are the questions we should be having.
Well, and my concern is the subsidies just mask the problems with Obamacare and with the broader healthcare system as a whole. I mean, the government has injected itself in so many places, it has driven up the cost so the average everyday American struggles to pay not just health insurance, but healthcare costs.
Yeah.
And this is one of those missed opportunities. Fine, okay, we're having the shutdown. I jokingly said this to folks, but I'm kind of serious. We should have just locked all the congressmen and women in the Capitol for the entire shutdown period.
Figure it out.
And forced them to negotiate on this, that, and the other. And hopefully they would have worked on some areas to say, okay, we all want the cost of healthcare to be down. Okay, what is it that we've done that has driven the cost up and work on that rather than, if you will, the Senate doing whatever the Senate did and the House basically going on vacation for 5 weeks.
I know that people feel like we, you know, are often getting along. We are. I do think that we get along. But I do think this is a great example of a key difference that we have, because you're saying, you know, what is government's role in driving up the cost of healthcare? I, of course, like to ask, what is the role of unfettered capitalism that's driving the cost of healthcare exploding in this country? And I just kind of go back to, you know, my girl Elizabeth Warren, capitalism without rules is theft. And where is it that we can find across our the way our structures work in this country and government to drive down costs? I couldn't agree more that we need everyday working people in the state need somebody to really be fighting for them. Unfortunately, that's not anyone that we've sent to Congress.
Shereen. Well, we don't have unfettered capitalism, so let's stop pretending that we do.
Yeah, and I think that's a good one for us to do a single show on.
Okay.
Healthcare reform.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
I know. You know, I have some ideas who we could invite.
Okay. John and Shereen, the Trump administration saying that they may not release the October inflation and jobs data. This is the Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Why not?
You know, well, government shut down. You know, did they get the surveys done?
Did they
have the workers to do it? There's a few times, very precious few in a government statistical accounting where they miss a year. That one happened during COVID, for instance, you know, and the like. But it's a shame because you lose a data point. And right now it's in the Trump administration's interest to not have that data out because we know quite clearly that inflation is bumping up. And that jobs are dropping.
Yeah.
Well, this is one of those things. I think Trump is falling into the same problem that Biden had. He's looking at certain statistics and trying to say, oh, the economy's better because inflation has been tamed or it's less than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what everyday buyers are looking at. They walk in the grocery store and see, are the prices up or down? And while the president says prices are down, they don't see prices down.
Yeah.
And maybe he's talking that inflation is not growing as rapidly. But that's not prices are down.
Yeah.
And so there's a disconnect. And so I think the electorate is going to hold him accountable just like they held Joe Biden accountable. And they're just ticked off as a result.
It's a talking point to essentially say, oh, it was so much higher under Biden and now it's so much better because there was a post-pandemic data distortion that came out of COVID that forced inflation higher. Everyone had their hands in that, meaning they passed these stimulus bills and then COVID limited supply of goods. And so you have too much money chasing too few goods and inflation spikes, got as high as 9%. It's at 3-something right now, about 3.1. Not good enough. We got to get it down.
Yeah.
Well, and when the president says prices are down, prices ain't down on most things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think this is sort of the central, I think the recent elections and general approval rating of the president suggests that he is susceptible to gravity, right? Like people are seeing this, they're experiencing it. They understand that life has become less affordable. And I think they also see a president who said he was going to go out and fight for them, but is absolutely happy to hand out billions of dollars to the wealthiest and to large corporations and do it at the expense of taking from you, taking from your neighbor, taking from most working people.
She pointed at you when she said you because you're high income, John.
That's right. High income. I've been high income my whole life, clearly. What I was going to say is, I know the president's feeling some pressure. We talked last week about the 50-year mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is that about? Trying to reduce the monthly payment for a house.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we all thought that was a bad idea, but okay, he's feeling pressure there. The $2,000 rebate to folks coming off of the tariffs, okay? Cutting some of the tariffs on, you know, bananas and coffee and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these things are an indication that he's starting
listening.
To see...
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's also run to the front of the parade on the Epstein files because he says he now wants the files released, which is interesting to me because he once denied that there even were files.
Yeah, that's right.
and that he was in the
it
files.
It wasn't until he could tell that they were going to vote against him and put him in a situation where he had to veto it.
I also think the American public does not want a government a Republican leadership that is protecting pedophiles. Like, this is truly the point that we are at. The kind of horrific sex trafficking of children that Jeffrey Epstein engaged in is something that we should all be able to
agree on. Get ready for the women vote.
Yeah.
On this
yeah.
one.
Or, I think it's a good time for us to call our representatives in Congress and let them know exactly how we feel on this, because they've been pretty quiet, except for John Curtis, who did say that he would
Props.
Vote in support.
Senator.
Proud of him for that. But I just think this is, it's horrific. The kind of violence that people endured is horrific. And we do deserve to know what happened here.
Did you read some of the emails, John?
No, I didn't read the emails. I did hear on the news.
Read the news reports. The emails are sort of interesting. There's just this fascination that Epstein apparently had with Donald Trump, because he comes up in so many of the emails. It just is a stunning amount of, information.
Well, there's some of those that say he was a sleazy guy, the worst of the worst. And then there's others that say he's really a plant by foreign governments to get dirt on all sorts of high-level officials in our government.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, the file should be released. We should know what's going on. Action should be taken accordingly. Hold the people accountable.
Let's do it.
And if there's really nothing there other than Epstein and Maxwell, then let's move on. But get it out there.
Yeah. Let's take a short break, and then I want to talk about Marjorie Taylor Greene. Thanks, everybody. Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gorbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on UPR. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. That's BSOTAPodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shereen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I want to talk to the two of you about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I'm sitting there on Sunday. I'm watching State of the Union.
One of Trump's staunch supporters, allies.
Dana Bash is a real pro, and she did a really, let's call it, how would I describe it? Just talented interview with Marjorie. Challenging her on some of the things she's saying, but also giving Marjorie a chance to talk and make her case. Marjorie Taylor Greene is turning a new leaf, Shereen. She's basically saying, I'm ready for a new path forward. I take ownership of the things I've done in the past, but we've got to change. It's got to stop.
Love to hear it.
I know. And Trump's called her a traitor.
Yeah.
And she's worried about political violence.
Yep.
Your quick take, and then
Well, I do believe she was held accountable for that because, she was confronted with the fact that her rhetoric has certainly led to an increase in violence and feeling that for folks on the other side of her words. And she said that she regrets that. Mm-hmm. Now, can a leopard change their spots? I don't know. I'm interested. But I also think that
she did it on national TV.
She did it on national TV.
On CNN.
I do believe one of my favorite features of people is when people have changed their mind on something, when people can reflect, learn, and grow. I am curious how much this has to do with her future political aspirations. Is she trying to run for Senate? Like, what is happening next?
John.
I tell folks, there's an interesting change that happens when you're campaigning versus when you actually have to govern. And I would say she was finally forced to have to govern in the shutdown and started seeing some of the issues and challenges there. She saw the impact on everyday Americans. She started questioning some of the comments the president was making about the cost of living. And clearly, she was adamant that the files should be released and got crosswise with the president over that issue. And so from my perspective, I don't know if there's some longer-term strategy or anything like that. I see somebody who was forced to have to deal with the reality of governing and started moderating or changing her position as a result of, I represent my entire district. I'm not just pontificating and campaigning and
raising
being
money
on Twitter. I've got to do certain things, and I got to work to bring the shutdown to a resolution.
Yeah, I called Dana talented. Marjorie Taylor Greene is really good in this interview.
Yeah.
She's a skilled orator, in my opinion, and I encourage our listeners to go look it up.
It's interesting. It's worth a watch.
Yeah. Okay, let's go local. We've got this redistricting going on. We've got this new congressional seat that looks more attractive to Democrats. Kathleen Rebe, a state senator, has entered the fray.
Absolutely, it's drawn for the Democrats.
Okay. Just like yours are drawn.
She used to be my senator. I live in Murray. She's not anymore. They changed the boundaries, but she's an educator. She's been in the state Senate. She has run before for Congress. She's got the bug.
She's got the bug. I will also say I find her to be a straight shooter. I do find her to be a very thoughtful person. And I think that she is really, I just think of some of the stories that she's told over the last few years around folks in her district really coming to her with concerns and her trying to run legislation on that. Yeah. And I do think that she's incredibly responsive. She listens. Mm-hmm. She's willing to change her mind and open to new ideas.
Is she going head to head with Ben McAdams for this?
Well, I think it's they are two of many. We're going to see a lot of people on this.
All right, John, comment on that.
I was going to say, I think we're going to see many. And this is one of those things. A lot of times, Democrats anoint somebody to run against the Republicans. Mm-hmm. So this is nice to see them coming together and having to make some choices within their own party.
What will happen with the R's on this new seat?
Yeah, any word?
On the new seat, I have no idea. But the way it is, it's like, you know, it's drawn. Like I said, three of the seats are hardcore drawn for the Republicans and one is hardcore drawn for the Democrats. There's anything of kind of swing seats or third parties having a chance to influence what happens. I don't see it with this map.
I think that's misunderstanding that district because I listened to Brian Schott break down sort of the wins that Republicans have had or the numbers that they've had in what is going to be CD1. And it is more competitive than I feel like you're
this new CD1.
Yes.
What I was hearing, it was like Kamala Harris plus 24.
Okay,
type
but
of.
I think that's a different question than what's happening down ballot. Like, look at Cox. Look at I think actually the data that he referred to was it the first or Sean Reyes vote totals there. I think it's worth a deeper look at that. And there's been some reporting in the Trib to really look at what this district is like. As a person who's run in Salt Lake County, it does take in, I believe, like West Jordan's in it. This is not a wildly progressive district. And in fact, what it does is follow the structures outlined in Better Boundaries, which was communities of interest, not over dividing counties as necessary. Sort of these core ideas that I think are good for us.
And if it really is Kamala Harris plus 24, this is a Democratic seat. Whether or not you want to call it progressive, it is clearly a Democrat seat. It's drawn for Democrats. The other three are clearly drawn for Republicans.
Yeah.
And so it'll be interesting to see what shakes out.
John, do you go so far as to say that there is some value for our state to have a Democrat in Congress, to have both parties represented?
Yeah, I'm great if California has some Democrats in Congress.
Do you believe
and what do you say about the, I don't know what it is. I don't know how you, I don't know the numbers, but let's say registered Democrats and then independents. But there's a big chunk of people that aren't represented by just the right wing.
So one of the interesting things from Prop 4 talks about communities of interest. Mm-hmm. And somebody asked me, how many communities of interest are there? And I said, infinite. There's infinite communities of interest. You may coalesce because of geography. Mm-hmm. You may coalesce because of employment, industry, or some other, you know, foster care or whatever it might be. There's any of a number of interests that you might coalesce around as a result. And so we're just drawing these boundaries a certain way. I think Prop 4 was pitched in a way that we're going to have more competitive races, more electorate involvement. I don't think this map results in that.
What do you predict happens moving forward? I keep getting asked, like, are these going to hold? Are these the seats?
I'm going to say, I don't know. I mean, the legislature,
okay.
I've heard
people say if they impeach the judge, her rulings all automatically become null and void. And
no,
I'm like, I've not heard.
That doesn't happen. So, I mean, I think the legislature clearly was appealing. I think they will continue to appeal through this process. Even if these maps stand for this election, I anticipate maps will be redrawn again. I don't think these last through the next census.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They will get redrawn. I think they're one of the key things the legislature is struggling with is the notion, which is, okay, the judge didn't like our first map, struck it down, didn't like the second map, struck it down. But when the judge adopts a map, especially of a special interest group, I mean,
like the legislature?
Didn't even adopt a map that was drawn by a legislator or even the independent redistricting commission.
That was something
that they don't understand how that works. And that's part of the frustration.
I totally get that point of view. One other quick question or just comment, but the Salt Lake Tribune ran a House editorial basically saying that the fingers that are being pointed at this judge that could lead to violence or that are just so mean-spirited need to stop. And they make the point that there were calls for impeachment within minutes of her ruling going out. which means that they didn't read the 91 page.
Right.
It just,
well, it wasn't within minutes. I mean, she released it at 11:40 at night, and the calls came the next morning. So there was sufficient time
to
read.
Within minutes of working hours, John.
That's a different question.
Okay. Hey, another one I wanted to just bring up. The Make America Healthy Again has been getting upset with cloud seeding.
Yeah.
We do a lot of this in our state. It's been done since the 1950s. Any quick comments there?
I will just say this was, so I'm from North Dakota, where cloud seeding also is a common practice. I think that this is just par for the course in just the absolute chaos that putting RFK Jr. in charge of a department brings. So, you know, bad idea after bad idea, as far as I'm concerned, and it makes it difficult to see the good ones, to see the good ideas or the real concerns. So I don't know. I think this is... just a political hack continuing to be a political hack.
Did you ever
have
to vote on cloud seeding in the legislature?
No, I didn't. But I would say life is full of trade-offs. And we've talked about the health hazards due to the dust coming off the Great Salt Lake. And so if this helps water it down and bring more water to the lake, then you would think that's a good thing. And so this is one of those things. It's like, okay, are they upset about something that's just completely bunk that they shouldn't? Or is this something where there's health trade-offs? Like Shireen, I'm not seeing that come out of here. I'm seeing a certain agenda being driven. Some aspects are good. Some aspects are wrong. And some aspects I would rather leave to the free market to decide rather than government dictating.
Sometimes on this program, we talk ideas and sometimes we talk people. And I'm going to talk people here. Joel Ferry, who leads the Department of Natural Resources, he is one of the most talented public servants I've ever met. Joel is amazing. He's the state water agent. Cloud seeding falls within his department. I have a ton of confidence in Joel.
Yeah.
I didn't tell you guys I was going to bring this up, but the Gardner Institute this week releases the state's new long-term population employment projections. We only do that every 4 years. It's a big deal. What do you want to know about
them? Well, very interested. So does it – tell me about kind of the way it's organized.
Well, basically, you know, we have about 3.5 million Utahns right now. We're projecting over the next 40 years we'll grow to 5.6 million. It's like adding the state of Idaho over 40 years.
But we're going to acquire
not through force.
Yeah. Just in the amount of people. Just giving you a comparable. About two-thirds of that growth will come from migration in our projections. That's a switch.
That's a change.
That's a switch.
Yeah.
Fastest growing.
Well, migration meaning people that have no connection to Utah coming or people that have a connection to Utah that have left that are coming back.
Well, all of that is net in migration. But we know from survey data about 1 in 4 are returning home.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. Fastest growing county, Wasatch County. This is where Heber is, followed by Utah County.
Yeah.
Utah's second largest county, followed by Washington.
Well, I've heard rumors that Utah County potentially is going to be larger than Salt Lake County.
Yeah, it does not happen during this projection horizon over the next 40 years, but it's getting close.
Yeah.
But Salt Lake County remains by far the employment center for the state, where most of the jobs are. Just a quick, and one other one. The population 65 and older goes from 1 in 8 to 1 in 4.
1 in 8 to 1 in 4. Now that's
dramatic.
Will
be 65 and older.
I think about that from the recent news of Salt Lake County closing a senior center. I think about that in terms of programs like Meals on Wheels or elder care. I think that the state has underinvested in an aging population. Yeah. They haven't had to, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if we'll start to see movement, and it should happen now from the legislature.
Just the theme is growth and change.
Yeah.
And I'd love to know more about what it's going to take for Utahns to have more kids, what this means in terms of fewer kids.
That's a great point.
I mean, it's hard to close schools, but when you have a shrinking population of students, you have to
do that to
deal with costs.
Yeah.
When I started my professional career, we had a births per woman about 3.2. Then it got to about 2.6 and stayed there for a long time. Right now, it's about 1.8. And over this horizon, we take it to 1.6.
Yeah. Well.
And what's Italy these days?
I don't know.
It's like
lower than that.
Lower than that, yeah.
I do think, though, that this ties into me for a larger conversation about where the state's priorities actually are. I spent the morning at the Utah Business Conference, which is a good, interesting convening, I think, in terms of the themes that you see. But I do feel like we have to get a lot more serious about tackling these challenges on the horizon in really collaborative ways. And I think some of these spaces, I hope that they feel stretched to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a lot of cultural and demographic shifting.
Yeah, yeah.
1 minute in the program left, Tim Ballard gets a break from the Salt Lake DA. Sim Gill will not file criminal charges against Tim Ballard. John?
Well, it sounds like he You just didn't have enough information.
Just didn't pass the test.
To be able to reach that higher threshold of what the courts require.
I would say, unfortunately, this is the case for most individuals who experience sexual violence. It is incredibly difficult to pursue legal avenues around sexual assault because of structural barriers of all sorts of varieties.
Think of the courage it takes to come out and speak to it and then to not see it charged.
Yeah.
That's got to be a real tricky thing. Have you worked with Simgill a bit?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, he's a pretty straight shooter, yes?
I mean,
no.
You would say no.
Not.
I was asking it to be provocative.
But I would say it is, the district attorney has to be one of the most challenging jobs in the state.
Yeah, and he's been doing it for a long time. Hey, well, great program. Thanks so much, you two, for the great conversation. Shireen Gorbani, John Dougal, Natalie Gochner, programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening, everyone.